Welcome back to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. The nature of consciousness has been debated for centuries by philosophers, scientists, writers, and arguably the whole world. But rarely is that conversation framed in the context of a willful loss of consciousness, such as during anesthesia. Kate Cole Adams, Australian journalist and author, has recently published a book probing the nature of consciousness through the lens of the medical industry's use of anesthesia. By creating a kind of associative history of anesthesia and a selective survey of recent advancements and studies in the field, Cole Adams probes the nature of consciousness as it relates to memory and pain. Her book, Anesthesia, The Gift of Oblivion and the Mystery of Consciousness, poses challenging questions about how we create and retain memory and about the relationship between consciousness and memory. Kate Cole Adams, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, and I want to tell everyone there might be a bit of a delay. So, Kate, your book is deeply researched and well-sourced. It includes several interviews with leaders in the anesthetic field. How long did you work on this book?
Well, this was a long project, far longer than I'd originally intended. I officially started working on it back in about 2004. But in fact, some of the very first interviews that ended up being in the book, I did in 1999.
Wow.
So it's been with me a long time. Yeah, I kept trying to get rid of it, but it didn't want to go away.
So you describe anesthesia as being, and you write, closer to alchemy than arithmetic. What do you mean by that?
Well, there were a lot of strange things I discovered when I started investigating, this sort of strange blank in our social consciousness. And, one of the things I discovered, I think I had always just imagined that there would be a recipe or a formula, and that formula would be applied and I would, or we would all be unconscious. But in fact, every anesthetic has to react with an individual body, and it means that, and there are a whole lot of different anesthetic drugs to choose from. So, different doctors will use different drugs, sometimes according to their preferences, but also, according to the patient. And different patients will need different amounts of drugs to knock them unconscious, mm-hmm. and a sort of a mix that will not knock someone out, will someone else will still be chatting. So it's a very in Australia we call them anaesthetists, but anaesthesiologists who I've spoken to have said, oh, look, really, this is more of an art, or as much an art as a science.
What are the planes of anesthesia?
Oh, look, there's various, the planes of anesthesia, it was basically a 19th century, I think, way of describing the different stages that you go through when you're given an anesthetic. And so it basically goes from fully awake to, slightly less awake to hopefully, and are unconscious enough that you can be operated on. And eventually the planes go down to you being dead, so you don't want to get to that one.
Yeah. No, you don't want to get to that one.
That's not where people normally,
work. Right. So, so we talked about the planes of anesthesia. Now, let's talk about what's in this. What's in this stuff? What are the three main elements to contemporary anesthetic cocktails, and what does each do?
Okay, these days, anesthesia is a cocktail. In the early days, it was just a single drug. But the anesthetic cocktail basically has something called a hypnotic, and the hypnotic's the part I suppose that we think of as the anesthetic. It's the bit that knocks us out. It's the bit that alters or removes or whatever however you look at it, our consciousness. There's also then an analgesic, a strong painkiller, so that your body won't be responding, or hopefully won't be responding to pain signals even when you're unconscious. And the third part, which is the part that hadn't even occurred to me, is something which is slightly euphemistically called a muscle relaxant. It's really a drug that paralyzes your muscles, It was developed from the poison curare, which was what Indigenous Americans used to use to for hunting. It was on, you know, it was on the tip of poisonous arrows, and essentially it was incredibly helpful for surgery, because it meant that doctors could actually go into parts of the body like the belly, the chest, that you couldn't actually open up those muscles and successfully close them to operate on otherwise. So, and it also makes sure that people don't wriggle around on the operating table. But it does also mean that you know, it includes disabling the muscles between your ribs, so you can't breathe unaided anymore. It's generally used in sort of bigger surgeries, and probably all up around about 40% of surgeries would involve you know, a paralytic drug.
I'm speaking with Kate Cole Adams, Australian journalist and author of Anesthesia: The Gift of Oblivion and the Mystery of Consciousness. So, Kate, is anesthesia sleep?
No. No, it's not sleep, and this is one of the areas that people are still trying to work out exactly what anesthesia is. There's evidence that it does recruit some of the sleep circuits, some of the brain's sleep circuits, but it's not sleep. I mean, anesthesia is really a reversible pharmacological coma. Is what it is. So each time you're put under an anaesthetic, your doctor is basically putting you in a coma, and taking you, you know, as deep as they can safely take you in that coma, in order to operate on you without you trying to get off the table, and then bring you back out again.
So you attempt to locate and define consciousness throughout the book. Is there one definition or test of consciousness that you ended up preferring?
No. I mean, I have to say also, you know, that really is not just me. When I started investigating anesthesia, I suppose the thing that I realized very early on into the process was... There's this tremendous conundrum. I mean, really, the first thing I sort of discovered was that anaesthetists and other scientists don't really know precisely how anaesthetics work. I mean, they've got a general idea about what happens. Yeah, I know. I found that fairly mind-blowing.
Every
which way. But I suppose the reality is, you know, anesthesia takes away an entity or a process called consciousness. We don't know what consciousness is. There is not agreement. There's a lot of people researching it, but there's not agreement about what consciousness is. And so I guess in a way, perhaps it should be no surprise that there's not really agreement about what unconsciousness is either.
Well, I'm sure a lot of anesthesiologists have these very philosophical conversations about what is consciousness and what isn't. But I have to ask you, Kate, because you've mentioned it a couple of times about, you know, making sure the anesthesia, the components of the anesthesia, you know, the muscle relaxants, to make sure that someone doesn't jump off the table. And I'm just wondering, how many people are estimated to remember waking up under anesthesia in the U.S. each year?
Well, there is an estimate that about 20 to 40,000 patients in the U.S. each year would wake and would remember waking if you asked them, probably fairly soon after the surgery. That figure's kind of extrapolated from formal studies where you're in a hospital setting and you're interviewed immediately after waking and then a couple of times after. But on those, and those are quite broadly used figures, you know, that it comes to a percentage of about one in every 500 to 1,000 patients would wake under an anaesthetic at some point and would remember it later.
You write that people remember more about a waking experience while under anesthesia a month from the time of the surgery than they do one day afterwards. Was this as surprising to doctors and researchers and you as it is to as baffling as it is to a layman like me?
To be honest, I can't recall exactly what the proportions were. Now, certainly, people were, you know, it was very confused the way in which people remembered. What would happen is some people would remember immediately after and then not remember later. Other people would remember nothing for a day, maybe a week, and then would, you know, a couple of weeks, maybe up to a month later, would have some kind of memory. It was one of the things that makes you realise it's actually very difficult to get a sense of how many people do wake during an anaesthetic, because it does depend on when you ask them. Yes, I was surprised. In terms of, you know, what anaesthesiologists and anaesthetists think about it, my sense is that a lot of people in the profession haven't traditionally thought much about it at all. And these studies, you know, what I discovered when I sort of went in and started delving around in the research was that there are all these, you know, there's a whole sort of huddle of smaller and some bigger studies about what might happen to us and to our consciousness while we're under anaesthetic. But most of these aren't generally discussed. They're not, you know, when you said earlier, imagining anaesthetists and anaesthesiologists sort of sitting around having these philosophical discussions about consciousness. My sense is that most of them, and I don't know because I don't know most of them, but in terms of people I've spoken to, I think there is a small group who are particularly interested in that, who think in those terms, who are psychologically minded, who are philosophically minded. But I think there's a lot of anaesthetists who are very practical. They're very interested in proportions and numbers and ratios, and they're really good at that, and you want them to be really good at that. But I think I think it's very confusing to be doing this job where basically, you know, like really, quite what is it that you are doing?
Right,
to think about all of that time.
Right.
You know, and plus there's, yeah.
Well, I'm
someone being...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go on.
Kate, I'm fascinated by the whole waking while under anesthesia, because I'm wondering if the number of people who remember waking up is smaller than the number of people who may actually wake up while under anesthesia.
You would have to assume almost certainly, given. And there's all sorts of. I mean, this is an imprecise area, but I suppose one of the complications of anaesthetics is that also a lot of anaesthetic drugs also, one of the other things that they do apart from making you unconscious is they mess with your memory, and some of them are really powerful amnestic drugs. So, in fact. You know, the fact that you don't remember anything when you wake up isn't much indication of what may or may not have happened during your surgical procedure. And,
right.
And in fact, you know, this is one of the things that I, you know, there's a whole area of anaesthetics which is where anaesthetic is the sedative doses, really. It's not formal anaesthesia, but, you know, if you go in for a process like a colonoscopy or one of those, some dental surgery, but maybe not that so much, but there are various processes where, as the patient, you can actually be, you know, at least partially conscious. You can be answering questions from your doctor. Sometimes you can be having a whole conversation that you simply will not remember afterwards. And the experience will be of nothing having happened and of having been unconscious.
Right.
I remember years ago my mum going to pick my dad up, he'd been having some surgery, and she went to pick him. She got the call from the hospital saying, you know, he's in recovery. You can go in and see him. So she went in and, you know, and said, oh, you know, hi, darling, how are you feeling? And he said, oh, I'm just still bloody waiting to go in. So
he remembered nothing.
He remembered nothing, which really suited him very well, because he had very strong memories of having an ether anaesthetic as a child, and that had been devastating. And I think that there's a lot of older people who have very frightening memories of having anaesthetics under ether, which was one of the first anaesthetics that was generally used. And no one wants to go back and have one of those anaesthetics.
Right.
They were very scary.
And Kate, when we come back from the break, I want to get into the whole issue of pain. But I have to ask you, because this whole piece about waking up while under anaesthesia is sort of weirdly fascinating to me. And I'm wondering, why do you think doctors and anesthesiologists are reluctant to admit that waking under anaesthesia actually occurs?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I'd preface it by saying that I think there's much more recognition now that it does, partly because too much is now known. But I sort of feel as if there's a funny thing about anaesthesia, and I think it happens on both sides of the fence. And there is a degree of denial. Traditionally, patients have been waking up really since the 1940s when the paralysing drugs came in. And they were fairly consistently told that they'd either been imagining it, that they'd dreamed it, or that they'd fabricated it. I think doctors don't like the idea that patients might be awake on their table. I think also patients don't really like that idea. And it's been a difficult book to write and talk about in many ways, because, I mean, I think a bit like you, I find anaesthesia completely fascinating. I think it is extraordinary what happens, and, I am intensely grateful for it. But there's a lot that we just don't know, and that is very unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Kate, hang on. I'm Jonathan Capehart. I'm speaking with Kate Cole Adams about her book, Anaesthesia, The Gift of Oblivion and the Mystery of Consciousness. We'll be right back after a break. We're back on Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Kate Cole Adams, Australian journalist and author of Anaesthesia, The Gift of Oblivion and the Mystery of Consciousness. Kate, before we went to the break, you had mentioned your dad and his ether anaesthesia and the pain involved with that. I just have to ask you to talk about a little bit about the relationship between one's emotional and mental state prior to going into a surgery and how much anesthetic may be needed.
Okay. I should preface all of this, of course, by saying that, you know, I'm not a doctor, so my understandings aren't, I'm not understanding things at the actual, the sort of level that you would need to as an anesthesiologist. But basically, one of the things that, it's a bit paradoxical, one of the reasons that doctors actually want their patients to be feeling pretty calm and relaxed and comfortable before they go under an anaesthetic is that when you're anxious, the adrenaline and adrenaline-like substances that you release in your body can actually work against the anaesthetic and can make it harder to put you under. So it's actually really important that you're not, you know, that you are feeling fairly relaxed when you go under, because otherwise it actually paradoxically increases the chances that the anaesthetic might not work as well as you want, or simply that doctors might have to put a whole lot more of the drug into you. And you don't want that much of, you know, you don't want more of these drugs in you than are necessary.
Can you talk about how then one's personal experience may impact the way they experience pain? Let me flesh it out a little bit more. So if someone is going into surgery in a heightened emotional or mental state, does that emotional or mental state that they go into surgery with, does that play into their experience of pain after the surgery, or even their memory of the surgery, or the pain of the surgery, or the pain of being under anesthesia?
I think, Jonathan, this is one of those questions that there's not yet an answer to.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, it is true that some of the most interesting research that I came across was research actually looking at preparations for surgery and what you could do or what doctors could do to help you come through an anaesthetic well. And, you know, I know New York's Mount Sinai School of Medicine some years ago, they did an experiment where they gave patients, before they went under their anaesthetic, basically a sort of 5 to 10 minute hypnotic conversation. You know, they read them a hypnotic script in which they suggested that they would have, you know, that they would not feel, they would have less pain during the surgery and after the surgery, less nausea, general suggestions about coming through pretty well. And what they discovered was that basically the patients, these patients as opposed to the ones in the control group, they came through, they used, their surgeries were shorter, they used significantly less pain medication during the surgery and after surgery, they recovered quicker and better, and the sort of cherry on the cake was that they estimated that per patient, that exercise saved the hospital more than $700 each. So, you know, the answer is, that's almost like looking at it in reverse. Certainly, if you go in more relaxed, and particularly if you go in having focused on, it's not just necessarily listening to nice music or feeling rested. It's something to do with the idea of focusing beforehand on how you're going to be during and after. And mm-hmm. who knows how that works? How do thoughts we have before an anaesthetic alter our experience during an anaesthetic? I think one of the things, this is just one of the sort of little bits I picked up along the way that kept on fascinating me, was surgeons or anaesthetists would talk about our patients. It was called, they even had a term for it, something, you know, as you go in, so you come out, or something like that. But basically, patients who went under laughing, as quite a few do, because those gases can be pretty nice, but patients who go under laughing have a tendency to wake up laughing. Patients who go under distress, you know, they're completely knocked out, they're inert, they'll wake up distressed. So,
well, that, I'm glad you brought that up.
One of the things.
Yeah. Well, Kate, let me ask you this, because you describe a study, a disturbing study, in which those who remembered being paralyzed because of the anesthesia had far more anxiety about their recent surgery than those who experienced pain. Can you talk about this study and its findings?
There've been a few different studies that have had that have drawn similar conclusions. So I'm not quite sure exactly which one that is, but one of the things that surprised me is that you would imagine if you were under anaesthetic and you did happen to be awake or to come into consciousness during that process, when it happens, some people feel, you know, they just hear things, or their eyes might open and they might see something. Not all of those by any means would be feeling pain, but studies have absolutely shown that afterwards, when they kind of assess people psychologically, and I think that this was actually a study that came out of Germany that we're talking about here. When it turned out that it wasn't, when they looked at the patients further down the track, and quite a few of them were still suffering some level of distress, some of them were suffering symptoms of PTSD, and it wasn't, you're quite right, it wasn't just the ones who were having pain. The predominant thing was the people who had actually been paralysed and who had been scared. So, you know, pain is one thing, and I think, you know, people have different capacities and preparedness to cope with some pain. But one of the things about waking up under an anaesthetic, and it's one of the things, I think is really important. People say to me, oh, look, I just don't want to know. I don't want to know about anaesthesia. I'm already scared. But I sort of say, no, look, there's a couple of things that are really important to know. And one is the fact of paralysis and the fact that you might be paralysed. What they have found is that people who wake up under paralysis, wake up under anaesthesia paralysed, if they have no idea that it's going to happen, which traditionally they haven't, and we haven't, well, imagine the sorts of thoughts you might have running through your head. You've woken up, you can hear people talking, you may or may not be in any pain, but you cannot move. You can't, you know, you're not breathing for yourself. And there are reports of people thinking that they've died, that they're in some sort of, you know, waiting room after death. There are reports of people thinking that they've had their spinal cords being cut and thinking that they're going to be paralysed forever. There is something deeply terrifying, and I think it really hooks into very primal fears,
mm-hmm.
completely powerless, paralysed, and having no idea what's going on. There is something about the combination of powerlessness and fear, powerlessness and terror, that is a very, very powerful brew in terms of breeding really, really. And it can be, you know, fairly devastating PTSD
right.
symptoms.
Yeah, people.
And you don't necessarily have to be in pain.
Right. People being more afraid of the effects of the anesthesia than the actual surgery that the anesthesia is for. Can you focus on advances made in so-called consciousness monitors as an area of anesthetic research? What are these and what are they measuring?
Well, you know, again, good questions, and I can tell you what they are. There is some uncertainty about what they're measuring, but essentially, these are monitors that have been developed over the last, 20, 30 years even, but you sometimes see pictures of people and they attach some little things to your forehead, and then you're attached to so basically it's a monitor. It reads your brain waves, and they can kind of tell that there's the most popular, the best known of these monitors is called the BIS monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big study, a big international study of it that actually came out of Australia came out in 2004, I think, the report. And that showed a significant, you know, an 82% reduction in awareness under the patients who used that monitor. Now, although admittedly those patients were all already higher risk patients. But the thing about the BIS, and the BIS is controversial, one of the things about the BIS is it, by necessity, it's measuring the brainwaves closest to the skull where you're attaching your information pads. And it depends on, given that no one's quite in agreement about what actually causes you to go unconscious, it's a bit like, my analogy is it's a bit like putting a glass to a wall to listen to the people talking next door. You can hear what's closest to the wall, but actually you may not be hearing the most important things in that room.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it comes back to the question of what consciousness is and what unconsciousness is, and what are we actually trying to measure with these monitors? And there's different opinions about that.
You had your own experience with anesthesia when you had spinal surgery back in 2010. What was it like to prepare to go under in the midst of writing this book?
It was a bit alarming.
Alarming?
A little alarming. When I knew that I had to have this surgery, and I have a condition called scoliosis where your spine curves, and I'd spent a long time in a sort of denial myself, very much hoping that I wouldn't have to have surgery. After I'd been booked in, I rang up the anesthesia office and spoke to the secretary there, receptionist there, and said, look, I've been researching this topic for a long time, and I think I might know too much. And she said, oh dear, that's not good. but the reality is, I actually found it very helpful. I found that in some ways it made me feel more nervous because there was more to think about and more to worry about. But, you know, I think maybe it's personality. I'm the sort of personality who likes to know
mm-hmm.
things.
But I also, as I went along, I found that the more information I got, the more the better informed I was, the more in control I felt. And it, you know, and in the end, when I went in, it was more like my attitude was more like, well, look, I'm getting on a it's like getting on a plane. We get on planes all the time. They make our lives so much better, so much more convenient. We all know at the back of our minds that there is a possibility that that plane won't make it.
Right.
But almost all of the time we get on the plane anyway. The other thing I'd say, though, was that in terms of my preparing for my surgery, I certainly used some of the information and used some of my research information to help prepare myself. And one of the strange, you know, in the 1980s, it was really when scientists first started investigating and taking seriously questions about not just whether you could be awake under anaesthetic, but wondering, well, in fact, that was happening from the 1960s. People started wondering, can we learn things under anaesthetic? You know, there were stories about people being hypnotized after anaesthetics and then remembering parts of the anaesthetics. So by the 1980s, they'd really started exploring it in a little bit more detail, and I came across an American medical psychologist called Hank Bennett, and he had done this bizarre experiment where he had given hypnotic instructions to patients before they went under, as it turned out, major spinal surgery, and among the instructions was the idea that once they'd been before the incision, they should draw their blood away from the incision site. This is to prevent blood loss, because spinal surgery typically can have a lot of blood loss. And so he was instructing people to, while they were unconscious, draw the blood away from the incision site, and then when they recovered, when they were sewn up, to bring the blood back to help recovery. Now, that sounded to me, I just could not wrap my head around that. But his study, a small study, a lot of these studies are small, and mm-hmm. some of them are replicated, some of them aren't. But his study found a really significant drop in, a significant reduction in blood loss among the people in that group. Before I went under my,
We've got about 30 seconds left, but I can't let you go without asking you. Okay. You described the experience of feeling like there were two yous writing this book. Quickly, what did you mean?
Yes. I meant there was the conscious part of me and there was the unconscious part of me, and it was a battle. The conscious part of me wanted to be in control, wanted to be a journalist. The unconscious part of me kept on having strange dreams, which have filtered their way into the book, because we tend to think of ourselves as just conscious, and we're both all of the time.
Kate Cole Adams, author of Anesthesia, The Gift of Oblivion and the Mystery of Consciousness. Thank you very much for calling in today, all the way from Melbourne, Australia.
Thanks, Jonathan.